but I have a technical third party check, I guess.
Doesn't matter. Because the interview is actually
with us, he is.
But the interview is really quite simple. I asked the people what was going on at the moment. And that is the short introduction to descriptive experience sampling. And the structure of, there isn't anything more to it than that. It's a quite simple technique. There's a little bit of skill involved in the implementation of it, but that's basically what happens. The structure tonight is that Jack suggested two volunteers who are Claire and Steve, and we met with Claire and Steve. I met with Claire and Steve yesterday, and they agreed that they would engage in this. And Steve wore the beeper this morning and met with me and had one of these interviews, which I guess I call an expository interview or something like that. Expositional interview. An expositional interview. We had an expositional interview today after lunch. And then he wore the beeper again. So his participation today will be his second crack at this apple, so to speak. And Claire got the beeper today at noon and wore the beeper this afternoon. And so I have not talked to her at all about any of these beeps, and she hasn't talked to me about it. So she has, I presume, six or seven beeps for us to talk about. And I'm going to conduct what I would call an expositional interview, and your task is to do whatever you want to do in that situation. You can ask questions or not. You can ask me questions. You can ask Claire or Steve questions. I have instructed Claire and Steve to answer your questions the way they think they would like to answer their questions without regard for what they think I might think about this thing. So give you a straight, a forward answer as they feel like it. And then one last thing about the structure of this. Claire and Steve have volunteered to tell you about something which is by its nature extremely private. And fundamentally private, but they're going to answer questions about their inner experience, and I would hope that we would treat that with the respect that deserves, so I'm going to post that on your website or whatever, without their permission or something like this. And so that's the structure, which is basically not much structure, except I'm going to interview Claire first, and then Steve, and anybody can ask anything or say anything, and I'm going to master of ceremonies that as well.
What did you ask them to write down?
I asked them to write down whatever they would like to write down in order to remember what their experience was like at the moment of the beep. That is to say, this was a note from them to them about their experience. I don't usually, and they're not going to in this case, look at what they've written. That's between them and them.
So just sufficient to drop their memories.
That's right.
As much or as little as we wish, basically.
Right.
And as we can, given the time, you know, given what else is going on.
Typically, people write down somewhere between one word and 100 words. I give them a small notebook, like Claire is holding right there, and most people don't write more than one page, so there are some exceptions to that. I give them a small notebook to encourage them not to write a whole lot. Other questions before we begin?
Actually, there was one, because I was trying to explain to Nick before the technology of the random intervals, and I just ran out. I couldn't remember.
The way the beeper works is that it has a counter in that says, say it counts from 1 to 1,000, and when it gets to 1,000, it beeps. And there's a clock in there that puts out pulses, so that every now and then it's going to get to 1,000, and when it gets to 1,000, it beeps. When it beeps, there's another clock that takes over, which counts from 0 to 1,000 very fast, like in about 1 millisecond it counts from 0 to 1,000. And then when the subject stops the beep, there is a number in the counter, which is sort of quasi-randomly chosen, somewhere between 1 and 1,000. And if it's 999, the thing beeps again one clock pulse later. And if it's 1, it beeps sort of a long time later. And for this particular demonstration, it was structured so that to get 1,000 beats took an hour. So there should have never have been more than an hour in between beats, but the intervals were randomly chosen by the variability of their reaction times to be somewhere between 1,000th of an hour and an hour in a uniform distribution.
Okay.
Any questions? Then if you're still willing, then... And the contract that, I guess I want to say one more thing about the contract, and that is that I would like to be able to ask any question that I would care to ask, and what I think gives me permission to ask that is that I have instructed Claire and Steve that if they don't want to talk about beef, they should say, I don't want to talk about that beef, it's none of your business. I told them that I've got things that are none of their business, and I presume they've got things that are none of mine. And if the beep happens at one of those times, they can just tell me. But if they agree to answer to let me ask questions, then I should be able to ask any question that I would like to ask. But they can always change their minds. If I start asking questions which they think are inappropriate or whatever, then they can say, I changed my mind, I don't want to talk about this anymore. But I would like to be able to be free to ask questions, and for me to be free to ask questions, I think requires them to be free not to answer them. But I would like that to be sort of an explicit thing, rather than a dance around thing. So what I don't want them to do is to say, well, there's part of this experience that I don't want to tell you about, but I'll tell you about the rest, because then I continue to ask questions, and they continue to hide, and we never get to what I think is the bottom of the end of the experience.
Can I ask a question in advance of that? Did this make you anxious and change your behavior in any way? And were there particular points in the session which you thought, God's sake, let the beat knock off now?
As I've done more of these, and maybe I should answer first. I mean, the answer to both of those is probably yes to some extent, but you know, I'm still sane and in my peace.
How can we tell?
Did it change your behavior?
Occasionally, I was conscious about the fact that a beat could be coming up, and it probably to some extent determined how I, you know, conducted myself or how I conducted my consciousness. I don't know if that is, an answer. I don't know if that's something that you think is good or indifferent or bad.
You didn't ask me, I asked you, so I'm happy to let you answer that question. But you also asked...
It's not so much the answer, but whether you think it interferes with the experimental...
I think it always does interfere with the thing. The question is not whether it does, but to what extent.
Yeah.
And I think for most people, not much after a while. It's pretty hard to keep track. And you should ask the subject whether they thought that their responses were in some way shaped. Their total overall behavior might have been shaped. But as a general rule, people wear the beep 4 or 5 sampling days, different sampling days in different situations. This is a sort of a special case where we're always in the same situation, and they know they're going to be interviewed in public with the same people that they're around when the beep goes off. So this is a quite unusual sampling situation, and probably with somewhat more pressure on the subject. They knew that they were going to be interviewed by you all when you all were presenting.
So we needed to collect 6 beeps in a fairly short period, and that probably...
Okay. I just wanted to say, the fact to work a bit changed a little my experience, because from time to time I was wondering, I was asking myself, what could I answer if the bit was beeping now? And I was imagining my answer, so it was a change.
And that is a typical response on somebody's first sampling attempt. It's not a very typical response on a second sampling attempt, because it's not a very interesting question to meditate about for a long time for most people. And they think about it for a while, but the second or the third day, that's pretty much it.
Could you move back just a little bit? Rusty, with the instructions to the subject, how long a time period are they going to talk about? Or it's up to them? Or is it instantaneously what they're thinking about?
I would like to know instantaneously. I would like to know as if we were going to take a flash picture, as a metaphor that I frequently use. I don't recall that I ever used that with either one of these guys. But I would like as if we were taking a flash picture of experience. The fact of the matter is that almost no subject understands that as short as time as I do, and much of the reason that I think this procedure has to be iterative, that is to say, it has to happen over several days, is because I need to train up people in how short a time that I'm really interested in, mm-hmm. which is a very short amount of time. I want to know that line and really know. So shall we interview here, and then you can ask whatever questions whenever you want, but I'd like to hear what the interview sounds like, and then you might have more important questions or whatever. So I would like to, and are you still willing to do this?
Yes. Oh,
okay. and that is a question that I would ask constantly throughout any subject, not just in this kind of situation. I want my subjects to be free men in this situation, free agents in this situation, and I make that abundantly clear to people all through, because I'm asking them about intrinsically personal things, and I want them to be able to say, I've changed my mind for whatever reason, and feel that they can do that without prejudice, and I think that's a very big deal as far as the way this project goes. So I would like to know what was in your experience at the first beat.
Yes. At the first beat, I walked down the road to come here after lunch,
mm-hmm.
and I'm relaxed after my presentation, and I'm imagining me at home when I come back to France.
And when you say you're imagining yourself at home when you come back to France,
yeah.
do you mean that as a visual thing, or just a thinking ahead with no visual stuff, or what?
Yes, it's a visual. It's visual because I'm just beginning to imagine a scene, but the beat comes and it cuts the my process of imagining something. But so I have a part of a scene.
Part of a visual scene?
Yeah.
And what do you see in this partial visual scene?
It's very vague. I'm in the forest with my... I'm a little moved to... the fact to remember, to imagining that moves me.
So an emotional thing?
It's now.
Oh, now?
Yes, just now. It's okay. I don't need anything. It's okay. Not too strong. And I was not so much.
This isn't too strong either. It's just, it's just more. But that's the best I can do.
It was not so strong when I was walking. I'm in a landscape that I don't know, but a landscape which is not like here. It's very more flat, like in my country. And
do you see this landscape, or do you just know that that's where you are?
No, I'm there. I'm there in this landscape.
Visually there.
Yes.
So that you can see the flatness of it.
It's very flat.
A vague but seen flatness.
Some springing landscape. I know it's spring, and I know that my husband and my daughter are just with me.
And when you say you know they're there, does that mean that you don't see them in this in this particular
image? No, I don't see them.
Do you see yourself in the image?
No.
So you see the landscape?
Yes. I'm walking in this landscape exactly as I walk down.
As if you are seeing the landscape from your own eyes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And is that a moving landscape, or is it like a scene that is still or fixed, or doesn't that question make sense?
I think it's a little moving, because I move, and it's vague. But I think that there are some movements on the trees, something, yes.
Mm-hmm. And when you said this is a spring landscape, what led you to say that? What do you mean it's a spring landscape?
I don't see anything very precise, but I know it's the spring. It's spring because it's the light, the air.
Okay, and is this scene in color, black and white?
Yes, it's in color.
And what colors are we seeing?
Green and blue, pink.
Okay. But I'm gathering that this is sort of like a pastel or watercolor kind of scene,
yes,
or something like that.
Yes, it's pastel. It's not precise. I don't see a tree there and flowers. It's just it's a forest. A forest. Okay. Yeah.
And you said that you know your husband and daughter. Did you say?
No, I. A daughter. She's 9.
And you know that they're somehow there. Can you say anything more about how you know that, or is it just you know that, or what's in your there?
It's the feeling of them, just the feeling of them. I don't see them, but I know it's a feeling that they are just with me, beside me.
And by feeling, do you mean an emotional feeling, or a bodily feeling, or a mental feeling, or what does feeling mean?
A very slight feeling. It's not an emotion. It's just I know that my husband is there. Just now. It's presence.
Okay.
And does
this presence have a place? For example, on your left side or on your right side, or in front of you or in back of you, or not? Or does that question make sense?
I don't see them, so I think that they are there. They are
one on each other.
Yes, but I don't know who is on my right and on my left. And it's vague.
Okay, and you also said somewhere along in here that there was an emotion in your chest that might have been now and might have been then. I wasn't sure about that. Were you?
Yeah, but in fact, I have an emotion now, but I noted something about my emotion. It's not the same, because I know that I was feeling happy, and I had a sensation here, a sensation or something opening.
So your chest opening?
Yes.
And from here to here?
No.
Just.
Yeah.
Okay, and when you go like this, are you saying that it feels like the opening goes out from beyond your body, as if the ceiling extends beyond the front of your body?
Yes.
How far in front of your body?
Not very far. So, and the beep, unfortunately, the beep cuts the sensation.
We suddenly lose some.
It's something like this. No, okay. Not.
And so this feeling, which seems like a bodily feeling, is partially inside your body and partially outside of your body?
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay. And seems to have a sort of a definite extent, because this much and this much, and so it's not this much.
Yes.
Okay. And you said about your visualization that was fairly, I forget exactly your word, imprecise or not clear or fuzzy, I guess you said. It's fuzzy.
Yes, fuzzy.
Is the feeling fuzzy or is the feeling clear?
The feeling is rather intense.
Intense.
But clear, I don't know if it's clear. It's intense.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so would you say that more of your consciousness or awareness or whatever we would like to call that is on the feeling than on the image, or is they both the same, or doesn't that question make sense?
No, I can say it.
Okay. And is there anything else going on at this moment, the moment of this particular beep, other than the...
I have to verify because... May I?
Absolutely. Mm.
Yes, at the same time, it was just a very, very, very short, but I asked myself something like will the weather be so fine in France? Le printemps en France.
But it's such a nice spring in France.
Yeah. So I ask myself. But
and when you say ask of yourself, do you mean in words?
No. It's just
so the wondering whether it's going to be nice and
yes.
When you get back to France.
Yes.
Is it
but I it's not words, it's just a question without words.
And this question that comes without words, does it come any other way other than just that you know that's what you're thinking about? Is it?
I think of something more or less visual, something which is darkening the initial scene.
Okay.
Something.
Okay, so the scene. So there's two possibilities here, and I would like to I would like us to distinguish between them if we can. One is that the scene is darkening, and now in the telling of it, you wonder whether that means that it's going to be bad weather in France, or whether you were at the same time, sort of in parallel with this with the imaging experience, also more or less separately, but in parallel, wondering whether the weather is going to be okay in France.
Yes, it was in the initial scene, in the initial experience, for a fraction of a second.
So there was like this thought that was separate from the image, or along with the image? Is that?
No, it was in. I was in France, walking, and it was very, very, very bright and nice, and a fraction of a second darker. And that was my way to ask myself about the weather.
Okay.
And
so is there anything else going on?
I don't think so.
And would anyone else like to ask anything of Claire at this moment?
The feeling of the opening up, was that, did that make you feel relieved?
Yes, it was that feeling, a relief, yeah.
And do you think it might be related to the fact that you had finished your presentation?
I think so, but it was...
Do you have your own explanation of why?
No. In fact, first, I was... There was just the second of the beep, and there was before when I was working, I felt relaxed because I had finished my presentation, and then just before the beep, I imagined this scene in France, and it was another feeling, close, but more. A relief to be home, to be back home, and a relief that spring is beginning.
So I would like to observe that that's the kind of question, both of those questions were the kind of question that I would not ask, because I don't think that the subject can be trusted to answer those questions. I don't think people know. This is, I guess, what Nick or somebody was saying earlier on. People. I don't think people know what causes them to do what they do. And I don't ask people things that I don't think they know about. So I would not ask that kind of question. It's an interesting enough question, but I think that there's no way to know the answer to it.
But if she had volunteered, then it would be okay. Or?
Well, if she had said in the initial thing something like, I'm feeling this opening up because it's a relief, mm-hmm. And I might ask her, is this relief directly in your awareness? And she said yes, then I would credit that as being yes, this was a feeling of relief. Mm-hmm. That isn't what I understood her to be saying, and so I wouldn't have asked her about that.
So your objective in the questions that you ask is really to confine your attention to the moment.
Exactly. I said at the outset, I asked people what's going on at the moment of the beep, and I meant that entirely literally. That's all I'm interested in. And the reason that that's all I'm interested in is that's all I think people can legitimately tell you. Mm-hmm. Any other speculation that goes away from the beep, like that question or almost any other question except what was going on at the moment of the beep, requires speculation that I think has been mostly demonstrated pretty unequivocally 30 years ago, that you just can't trust the answers to. And so I don't ask them. later on, there may be patterns. If we sample with her for a long period of time or something like that, there may very well be reasons that I, or she and I together, after we have looked at a lot of beats, might be able to infer something about a relief pattern. And that would be an entirely different thing, because then I could say, well, look at beat number 1, and beat number 4, and beat number 17, and beat number 24, you showed relief. And she would say, yes, you're right, that's true. But that is an entirely different thing. That is what I would call a true generalization about her experience based on actual collected and observed experiences. And that's much different from the kind of speculation that I think sometimes goes as Rich would say. Any questions about beat number 1? Then I'm interested in what was in your experience at beat number 2.
Yes, I was on the balcony, on the
balcony.
Yeah. And I was Jack asked me to help to put the cushions on the floor, and there are funny cushions that unfold. And I was watching Jack unfolding the cushion, and I was wondering because I wanted to make the same thing, and so I was watching him.
Oh. And that's it? You're watching him unfold?
Yeah, and that's the bit before that I can unfold my cushion, the bit goes on.
Okay, and so is what you're saying that at the very moment of this beat, you're watching Jack unfold, and that's basically all that's in your experience?
Yeah.
And are you watching, is there anything that qualifies that or characterizes that, or other than you're just watching him do it? Like, you could be saying to yourself, I wonder how he's doing that, or I want to do that right, or you could be having a picture of your own, or nothing, or you could be just watching him either one.
No, I'm watching it. I don't think I talk to myself. No.
I didn't mean to be suggesting that I thought you were. I was just trying to open the door a little bit to the possibility.
Okay. No, I'm very concentrated on the way Jack is unfolding the cushion.
Fascinating. And is there anything else in your awareness at this particular moment, other than...
I just noted that I have a sort of distorted vision of the scene. I'm not aware of the scene and the balcony, but a sort of distorted vision of... It's just Jack, the cushion unfolding, and it's a very... I don't know,
As if your visual process has somehow been distorted? Is that what you mean? So the question is it that the cushion itself looks jagged because of the way that it's unfolded? Or is it that your seeing of the cushion is somehow jagged?
No, because in fact, I'm very concentrated on that. I don't see the rest of the scene, and when I try to describe it, I remember the scene as a little distorted. It's not something large with everything around me. It's just I don't see anything else. It's just Jack and the cushion.
Okay. And so by distorted, you mean focused directly on Jack and the cushions and nothing else? And that's sort of surprising to you? Is that? Mm-hmm. Is that? I'm trying to understand what you mean by distorted, basically.
Yes. Yes. It's a little distorted, because it's not exactly Jack and the cushion. It's a little distorted.
Like twisted?
Yes, twisted.
Like Jack is twisted?
A little, a very little. I'm sorry.
Okay. And are the, how about the Christians? Are they twisted as well?
Yeah.
And so does it seem like the whole scene is a little bit twisted? And by a little bit twisted, do you mean like that much or this much? Or? Mm.
Very little.
Just, but a little bit twisted.
Yes, very little.
Okay. And at the moment of the sleep, is there anything else going on other than that? So at the moment, what I understand is that you're seeing Jack unfold the cushions in this direct seeing of Jack that's somehow a little bit twisted. Is that it? And I'm not trying to say that there should be more, I'm just asking.
I cannot say I'm anxious, no. It would be very, very too strong, but I'm a very little wondering if I can do the same thing. It's not very difficult, so I'm not anxious, but I'm just a little...
aroused about it, or...?
Yes, or attentive.
And is that what we call wondering or arousal, or whatever we want to call that, is that a mental thing, or a... emotional thing, or a bodily thing, or nothing about
it? No, it's bad. It's something a little physical, but very, very slight, very
okay.
Almost nothing. Just very, very, very little sensation of yes. I don't know. I don't yet know how to do, but I know soon.
And by physical thing, you mean in your body? The sensations in your body, small, but in your body?
Yes.
Head to toe, or a particular part of your body?
I don't know. So it's so slight, what do you say?
Slight.
So slight. Maybe something that, maybe, yes, the top, the that.
Okay.
It's not...
Well, okay, but a very slight, like a hint of something in you, like a broken thing. Okay. Anyone else would like to ask anything about that?
Your recollections are largely visible in both cases. If you've got five sensory blasts, anything going on in sound, smell, taste. Can you, in retrospect, close your eyes on that situation and identify anything else?
Do you want me to try? on this one?
Mm-hmm.
The last one? Mm-hmm. Yes, there is an environnement sonore.
The sound. Of the surroundings.
Yes, mm-hmm. But it's like I'm not listening to anything. Nothing presses. It's just there is something sound around. Yes.
Ambiance? Like the ambiance?
Yes, an ambiance. Yeah.
That, by the way, is an answer that I would not trust, and that I, because I think you work too hard at that by asking her to close her eyes, and I think you're asking for trouble. You're asking for people to make things up, and I would try to encourage people not to make things up. The risk of my way of doing it is that it might have been there and I missed it. The risk of your doing it is it wasn't there and you found it. I think that's a bigger risk. And so I worry about that much pressure, what I would take to be pressure. And I would say about my... some of my questions, I asked some leading questions in directions that I actually thought were in the wrong direction. Early on in my questioning about this people, I asked her whether there were words or something like that involved. And the reason that I did that was a couple of reasons. One is I wanted to opened the door to other kinds of experiences. That was a legitimate thing. But I asked about things which I thought were fairly unlikely also, so that she could get some practice in denying my requests, so that she just doesn't get into the habit of assenting to everything that I ask for. So one of the characteristics of my method is that I try to undermine my own credibility at every step, and that would be an example of how I would do that. I would like her to understand that I'm interested in what her experience is more than I'm interested in her trying to please me, and I do that in a lot of different ways. That would be one of them. Any questions about that? Particularly. Number three.
Okay.
Before you talk, I can ask one more time about your question. If I am interested in that, for whatever reason, I'm interested in the richness of the modalities, for example, I might ask that kind of a question that you asked, and I might even do it the way you did it. Then I would try to undermine it and say, well, this is really training for next time around. What I would like you to do is to make sure that we don't overlook any other mm-hmm. sensation. But I think I've actually been doing that anyway, even though I didn't explicitly name the sensation. But I would have no objection to explicitly naming. I just wouldn't believe the answers that you gave in this case. But as far as training for what comes next time, if we were going to do this again, that's sort of legitimate. The problem is that I don't want her to get the feeling that I favor one thing over another. Because that runs the risk of her trying to please me, and I don't want to do that. It is a delicate thing for her to understand that pleasing me is being in contact with her experience the way it is, regardless of what she takes my presuppositions or interests or whatever. Because she certainly has them. Everybody has presuppositions about me or everybody else, for that matter. I want her to set those aside. I'm sorry. Keep moving through.
So, we after the meditation session, there, sitting together, and Madeleine, just before the beep, Madeleine is explaining something about heart transplantation. And in fact, I don't understand quite well what she's explaining. And yes, I'm really focused on her trying to understand what she's explaining. And Jack is on my right. Has just said something to me about that. Just that we were talking about heart transplantation. So he had just talked to me, and I'm partly oriented towards Jack and partly towards Madeleine that I'm trying to understand.
So you're trying to understand two people at a time, basically?
No, because I've understood Jack, but I'm still with him, and most. With Madeleine, who is talking?
So your attention is to some degree divided with Madeleine and with Jack?
Yes.
And would you say 60-40, 80-20, 90-10?
Maybe 20% Jack and 80% Madeleine.
And so you're intently listening, is that?
Yeah.
And is there any other way that you have to describe that intent?
Oh yes, I see her. I'm focused on her, on what she's saying, and I'm looking at her, and I see a sort of image of art, an art, on Madeleine's chest, their sort of image of art par-dessus, enfin, between me and Madeleine.
So it's not on Madeleine, it's between you and Madeleine?
Yes, but it's near Madeleine.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when you say an image of a heart, do you mean an image of a human heart or a
no.
heart?
No, a human heart.
A human heart?
A human heart.
Okay. A pumping heart?
Yeah.
You see the heart beating?
A little movement, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And is this a clear picture of a heart, a vague picture?
Not that vague.
And so you said in your first piece that was a vague picture of the flat landscape. Is this vague in the same way, or is it vague in a different way, or more vague, or less vague?
Difficult question, because I'm it's not the same type of image, because it's a very, it's little, it's just a heart, and the landscape was very everywhere.
Okay.
So it's...
Is it heart-sized? Is it the correct, the normal size of the heart?
No, it's bigger. Not like that. Like that. Mm-hmm. With colors.
Okay. And I might interrupt this process a little bit, which I wouldn't normally do, but for explanatory purposes, I've asked a couple of questions here that I haven't asked in order to get the answers that I would believe. So, for example, I asked her whether this was 60-40 or 80-20 or 90-10, and she said 80-20. And I don't really care whether it's 80-20 or 60-40 or whatever. My purpose in asking that question is to get her to focus on the experience. That is, that's a device to ask about 90-20 or whatever. 80-20 is a device to get her to focus, which I think worked quite successfully. And the same thing was true when I asked her about the comparison between the vagueness in this image and the vagueness in the first image. I offered that question as a way of giving her the opportunity to refocus on two experiences, which I think if you were watching carefully, you could see her work very hard to bring both experiences back to mind. Not because I'm particularly confident that she can do a good job of making that comparison, but because in the training mode for day two, that kind of thing is going to make her a better observer the next time around, because now she knows something about the characteristics of her image that took her by surprise. Well, this one was little and that one big. I don't have any idea what that means, but she does. And it will make her a more accurate observer of her experience on day two of the sampling. So the method that I'm embodying here is I call an iterative method. It cannot be done in one shot, I don't think. You have got to acquire it over some number of days of practice of doing this kind of interview. I think Claire will be a better observer the next time we do this, if we were ever to do it again. And then in the course of that conversation, she would become a better observer the next time around as well. And it generally takes couple of 3 days for people to get modest or good at it. Claire seems quite good at it actually on the first day. This is quite good for a first sample day. Is there anything else going on at this particular moment? Okay. So I asked Claire to get 6 beeps, and I don't think we're going to have time to talk about all 6. So this is what my plan is, and I'm open to suggestion about that. I'm going to ask Claire about one more beep, and then I'm going to set the timer on my watch for 5 minutes, and we're going to take a 5-minute break, and when we come back, when my timer beeps, 5 minutes from when I said it, then I'm going to start asking Steve about his sample.
Can I just ask Claire one more question about that last beep? As you're listening to Madeleine, are you translating into French?
No.
No. No. You're sure?
No, no, I'm sure. No. No, no, I'm directly on the meaning that I don't understand very well. But I try to catch the meaning.
Can I ask just a quick question? So you said that Claire's first three responses are very good for a first time round. Do you think that has anything to do with Claire already being involved in first-person analysis?
Could be. Although, that's the kind of thing that I don't generally speculate about, because the hardest people to sample with very often are people who are really into this kind of stuff. They've got way too many preconceptions about the way it goes. So my guess is the answer to that is probably no. It has more to do with Claire's personality and personal characteristics. But I would give a very low validity estimate to that answer.
Yeah, it was just that earlier when Claire asked us to visualize a cherry tree, she asked whether we were thinking of it as a real tree, or whether it was a photograph, whether it was colored, whether there was any sound, so whether there were any other sensory modalities involved. And that's sort of question that you've been...
Yeah.
Maybe it's not the good time to talk about that, because now I'm the interviewee, but I think Ross method and like the techniques, the interview techniques we use, seem very close, in fact, except a bit, but it's. I think it's very, very close, but it's not the good time to make this comparison.
Yeah. I would like to hear, though, maybe after Steve is done, if we have some time, if you have some reflections on that, and maybe Russ has some reflections on. I think they would be very interesting.
Whatever things people want.
I have a question about the method. How do you distinguish between things that might be added on because of the beep? I mean, knowing that you have to report the beep, I assume that you would tend to kind of add details to the scene that weren't really in your consciousness when the beep happened.
I think that of Claire's responses, some of them were actually going on at what I would call the moment of the beep. Some of them were made up. Some of them were embellished. And the question is, how much? And the answer is, I think, for most people, most of the time, not too much, but for sure some. So I don't ever make a claim that I get to pure, unadulterated experience, because I don't think I do. I think I do convey that I don't want her to embellish things. I think I convey that in a lot of different ways. And over the course of many days or several days of sampling, I will convey that in a lot of different ways, that I'm not interested in embellishment. Very frequently, I've been doing this for a long time, and I can smell what embellishment smells like, and if I do, I will say I'll detect embellishment.
For the
Ajoute
des détails imaginaires.
And if I do in that kind of situation, then I will explicitly say to the subject, I would prefer that we don't embellish. But I would say that anyway. But particularly if I think maybe there's some embellishment, and I will say, I don't think you know whether you're embellishing or not. So I'm not, and I for sure don't know whether you're embellishing or not. I would like us not to embellish, if we can do that. That's part of the iterative training. Whether we are ever perfect in that, I don't think so. Whether we get to be pretty good at it, most people do. Somebody asked me yesterday whether anybody ever just has me on and lies to me all the way, and I suspect the answer to that is yes, but why would they? Some people do, but probably not too many.
But part of this is telling a story, like you create a scene that, okay, I was walking here and I was doing this, which is the background to the experience. It's not part of the experience, because you're not really experiencing that when you're doing it, but you're saying that because for the benefit of the interviewer, because you're telling him where you were and what you were doing. And at some point, it seems to me that has got to stop and say, the interviewee has to say that, and now I'm going to tell you exactly what I saw. Up to now is just kind of giving you the background.
I think that's true, and I think Claire did that pretty well, in the first scene that you're talking about. I didn't think I had much of a question about what was background and what was actually the beat. And that's what I meant by saying that Claire was pretty good at it. Most people give more background, and so much of the time I have to remind them, well, that's background, I don't really care about that, I'm interested in what's going on at the beach. I didn't feel like I had to do that with Claire. A typical sampling day involves a lot of that. And Claire seems to be pretty focused on what was going on at the beach, and pretty clear about the distinction of what was before the beach and what was after the beach.
Supposing this is another wild suggestion, but supposing there was what was going on at the moment of the beat was, as Dermot would say, there were multiple drafts in consciousness running in parallel. She was actually doing a whole lot of different things. And what the effect of the beat is, it's rather like collapsing the wave function in Schrodinger's cat, whatever it is. So when the beat comes, then suddenly, of all the things tripping on, one has to come into consciousness to crystallize. How do you distinguish? I mean, couldn't it be that her consciousness is being created by the beat? And as you know, all of us, whenever we catch ourselves thinking about something, of course there has to be something there. It's like we open the fridge door and the light is on. But actually, if you hadn't done the beat, she would probably have been having not just one set of thoughts, but really a lot of different ones. I want to suggest, I actually have this as a model for explaining apparent coincidences. When the telephone goes, and you pick it up, and suddenly it's Russ on the phone, and I was just thinking about him. In order to explain this very common phenomenon, I suggested that actually we're running all these parallel things all the time. We're actually thinking about 50 different people, and at the moment the telephone goes and it's Russ, then that crystallizes the thought of Russ, which was in my mind. But actually, there were a whole lot of other things that were going on already. And I think, it's very hard to distinguish the possibility that, when you say we're trying to get her to report what was in her mind, surely what she reports was in her mind, but it may have been one amongst 100 different things.
And my answer to that is yes, absolutely, that may be what happened. And so I do not consider myself an expert nor even a knowledgeable person about consciousness as maybe you would think about it. I'm interested in what experience can happen at the moment of the beep, and that's it. Whether there were other 9 other things that all were actually going on and all went away because the beep came, I think that's a totally possible. That said, well, we should ask Claire and we should ask Steve, did you have any sense at all that there was 9 other or 99 other things going on that suddenly went away when the beep came and left just this one?
No, but I do sympathize with Nick's question.
Right.
I do think there is something, I think it's a very nice way of putting it. I do feel there is a sort of, maybe not embroidery, but a kind of decision making that goes on when you describe that somehow, that there's a sort of, it's partly capturing what's there and it's partly putting something there. I'll put it this way, that I feel I'm in a space where both these things are possible, and I'm, constantly moving between the two.
I'm sympathetic with the possibility, and I have asked my subjects that thousands of times over the years to try to see whether I could get any kind of evidence about that.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, I can never get any kind of answers about that. So I think it's pretty unlikely. But I have no way of knowing, and so I wish to be on record as being totally agnostic about it. I have no idea. I don't see any reason why I should believe in it, but I don't see any reason why it's not possible.
Let me say one thing, though, based on the fact that I did this last year as a interviewee, and we talked about it a little bit then, too, and that is that, in fact, it's not just the case necessarily, and even in Claire's answers, that she only had one thing that she reported on. She reported on 2 or 3 things, and my recollection is that, at least on 1 or 2 of my samples, I reported on maybe 4 or 5 things that really weren't related to each other. And it may be that there were additional ones besides that. That's certainly true. And I remember asking about that at the time and asking, was that common? And your answer, if I remember, was some people just report on one thing, some people report on bunches of things.
And some people sometimes one and sometimes bunches.
Yeah.
And that would be some of the evidence that I would take to say I think it's unlikely that there's these multiple tracks going.
You did say, Russ, just before that you thought that, you know, a certain proportion of what Claire or probably I were reporting was
disclaimer.
True. Okay. Probably me too.
Both of you.
This is a slightly different question, but it's similar. It seems to me that the feed is a conditioned stimulus, the way you had set up this thing. So there's a positive reinforcement about whatever content was in consciousness. And, you know, and positive reinforcement tend to strengthen associations with may or may not have been in consciousness at the time of the beat. Is that clear what I'm saying there?
Well, I think so.
Because if you're now programmed to give attention to what was in consciousness at the time of the beat, the very act of giving that attention has now strengthened or altered what was in the consciousness, and usually altered the associative patterns with that. So you tend to have richer associative patterns after the fact than you might have had before the beat actually occurred.
Well, I don't know that I'd call it positive reinforcement, because my sense of positive reinforcement is it takes more iterations than I generally give. But I do think that that this method alters people's awarenesses. Claire is never going to be the same person again as a result of this experience. Sometimes it's pretty dramatic for some people, but sometimes it's not much different. But I do think it does change people.
I'm not raising that. I'm actually saying that the beat itself has changed the content of what.
I totally agree. I totally agree with that. How much it changes the content?
That's difficult.
It's difficult to know, but I can't see any reason to think that it's much. That doesn't mean that it's not much in the same sense that there might be 99 other drafts going on. But I ask as carefully as can be asked about what is the possibility that there was that this is different from what was actually going on at the beat, and people cannot answer that question.
Did I understand you correctly on the drafts? Sue Blackmore, last year's Tucson, she did a presentation where she tried to test the multiple drafts model. She created an experiment. It's not worth going into what her experiment was, but we know Sue buys into the Dennett model before the get-go, and her experiment did not reinforce it.
Right.
And so I gathered from you when you were responding to Nick earlier that you may get people give you multiple things that are in consciousness, and they may not all be apparently associated, or they may just have multiple thoughts or whatever, but that you don't get much that you think reinforces this multiple draft model.
Is that correct? That's correct.
Yeah.
But I also think that it's possible that it's there and that my method doesn't get it. Can't possibly get it. I don't think that's very likely, but I think it's quite possible.
But just wondering, at some point, this might not be the right point in the stream to do this, but I would like to get a little bit of exposition from you of what you're looking for when you do this, and perhaps the evolution of your methodology, why you went in this direction, and I'd be very interested to hear that.
Okay. I'll put that on the agenda.
Just very quickly. Obviously, you've spent many years developing skill to enforce a rigorous parsimony on this testimony. So I wanted to sort of take it the other way, because the other people who do this and in really serious ways are interrogators, right, for law enforcement. And their technique almost universally is to ask the same questions over and over and over and over and over and over. And they get two benefits. Number one, the witnesses tend to unpack their stories, and they gain detail. And secondly, they look for consistency. So I wondered how that relates to what you're doing.
Well, I think this method is quite a bit different from that, because those interrogations are usually about some event that has already taken place. And I, as Claire knows, am reluctant to spend too much time talking about a single event that has taken place in the past. I would much prefer to spend our time talking about one event that's in the recent past, and then move on and talk about another event that's in the recent past, and then in the future do that again after she has built some skills so that the next time that event happens, she's ready to talk about it. So I want my witnesses, or my interrogatees, whatever those people are called,
torture victims,
bad guys, to be skilled observers. I want to teach them to be a skilled observer before the event happens. Mm. And that's a very different thing from the eyewitness testimony or interrogation model. So I want to teach, part of my goal here is to teach Claire to be a better observer tomorrow. I hold very lightly what Claire says today. I'll hold a little bit more tightly what she'll say tomorrow.
But your methods really would be applicable to law enforcement in terms of the, you know, not trusting all of the testimony, correct?
If you are interested in the truth, which I guess some law enforcement is.
We should probably move on.
Right?
So would it be all right with you if we stop at those three beeps?
That's okay.
I'm sorry, we only got the three. And so I'm going to set my watch for 5 minutes right now. And then when the beep comes back, then we're going to come back and talk about Steve.
Talk to Steve.
Not about you. Well, about me as well. Please don't talk about me. He's going to be talking. Russ, did they ever say nothing? Did they ever say that? I don't know what I was thinking, what was in my consciousness.
Yes. Well, that's two different questions. Sometimes people will say there was nothing in my consciousness, and some people will say I can't remember. And my response to that is I'm happy to have you saying that you can't remember, because I don't want you to make up stuff. And so I can't remember, or I don't know is a perfectly good example, and I reinforce that as strongly as I can. The nothing response, that there was nothing going on in my consciousness, is a fairly rare event across garden variety people. It's more common among adept meditators, of whom I have sampled just a few, but there's the small samples a little bit higher frequency there.
Do you get the examples of, as in dreaming, that the dream has led up to the beep, so that they were, what was in their consciousness was something which had to be interrupted by a beep?
So actually a sleep dream?
Well, I mean, someone is daydreaming, let's say, when an alarm clock goes off, people will often report that in the dream the fire engine had just arrived at that point, yeah, or whatever it might be. Do you always get reports of anticipatory reveries which led up to the beep?
I was thinking about boiling some eggs and they were just about ready and then the beep went off, yeah, and that was the timer for the eggs.
That's it, perfect.
I guess I don't know.
I was stuck in a microwave. I dreamt I was stuck in a microwave and I was turning round and round and round and I was almost burning, you know, to a crisp, and then suddenly ding, and the door opened.
It seemed to me that you had a beep that was similar to that, but I can't remember what the beep was.
No, it was about a dream.
Not similar to a microwave, but it's...
Which part of this is the 5-minute break?
I was just offering people an opportunity to stretch.
Have you ever tried to sample people's dreams when they have been beep during
dreams? On occasion, the beeper goes off and people are asleep, and it was not a very effective.
Oh, wow.
I have got a dozing one.
You look at my screen, I
don't know. No, that was private to me.
My screen holds.
Your what?
Screen.
Your screen. Oh no, I was looking at Your screen. Oh, well, that's all right.
Are you going to ask me new songs for
Facebook?
I didn't have any PMT. My PMT was an AMT. It was an absent music track. But actually, there wasn't. You asked me what tune was going through my head this morning. It was La Vie en Rose. Because we were talking about that at breakfast. Yeah. Well, it just happened because we were talking about it at breakfast. But it didn't happen. It didn't figure in any of my things this morning. And I had nothing to I can remember going through my head this afternoon.
Could you sit there and tell us all the cheap songs that were in your head? Dolly
Parton
9 to 5.
Oh no, no! What have you set off? I'll probably have that all night until 5 in the morning. Right. Whenever you're ready,
you're down to double digits.
All right. Double digits of what?
Seconds.
All right. Oh, it's supposed to triple digit. Did you? It says OO. Yes. Oh. All right. Oh, 11. Okay, 10 seconds. Oh yeah, the coincidence is that Russ showed me his guitar today, which is has got in order to be portable, it's got the pegs below the fretboard, so it's actually got it below the where the right hand is. And the seasoning, John told me that he has a bass guitar which has a fret pretty below the same, basically the same design. That's a thing. Yeah. But I guess you could explain it because of, it's a new design, it's around, I mean, it's got fantastic in it, and if we come to conferences, maybe what so these sort of people want to have portable instruments. But it was within, you know, 3 hours, 3 or 4 hours.
But I was waiting for one.
Yes.
Not very often.
And not usually.
It's a big song.
True. That's a good song. It's a kind of high pitched. It's really not a beep. It's more a whine.
Did you get? Do you ever get phantoms beeps?
I can imagine.
You could ask about the good
time. Who asked about the good time? Ross, do you ever get people having hearing phantom beeps and
outward
and
no.
It goes on until you switch it off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
except, man, I found I was. It went on because I moved in my. I moved. But as I heard it, I moved. And that switched it off. And then I tried to press it and it switched it on again.
Yeah. If it's in your pocket, yeah, you can push the button. For
yeah,
sure.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay, folks, the time has come. And so the plan was that this would be the second interview for Steve's. And the reason that it was the second interview was that I would like to demonstrate that this is an iterative procedure and the second interviews are sometimes different from the first interviews. Claire was quite good at her first interview, so it might be that there's not too much difference between the first interview and the second interview. That is sometimes the case. Sometimes there are dramatic differences between people's skill level and the from the first day to the second day. And the other reason is that I asked to do this with a one interview and a two interview deal is that, in my experience, the people who are very often the most difficult people to sample with are philosophers. And it's an empirical fact, and I don't really know why that is. I will speculate. I can speculate about it. It seems like there are more presuppositions about the way thinking is and more resistance to having something be different from people's presuppositions, and it's harder for philosopher types to bracket that than for normal people. And And so I thought it might be a good idea to at least have the opportunity to have a second crack at somebody. The possibility that I drew two people who were of this difficult type of example. But it has turned out that was not the case. You're going to need to take that as a precaution.
What about psychologists? Aren't they
allowed to do this? Psychologists generally just refuse to do it. So do philosophers for the most part.
When they refuse to do it, what do they say?
I'm too busy. It's a good idea. Oh, it's a great idea, Russ, but I just can't do it this week.
Okay. That's about philosophers, you know, I understand your speculation. I would have speculated that they're too busy trying to theorize about their experience.
Right. Same deal.
Okay. Yeah.
That's what I meant. Yeah. Probably a different way of looking at the same thing.
Of the philosophers you interviewed last year,
that didn't happen. I didn't interview any philosophers last year. What's the one you want to call? Jack a philosopher.
But those are fighting words.
I don't want to not call him a philosopher, but he's not a great literary philosopher.
I'm
just
thinking
it's
excited.
You were informal.
I said this cloud will never get said again after this. Have you actually followed up on that any consequential results? You know Jeremy Pennebaker's stuff on getting people to write about it themselves for 15 minutes, which you can show effects on their immune system 6 months later, I mean dramatic effects.
I have seen what I would call and what the subjects themselves would call genuine miracles about life-changing events as the result of taking a look at 30 microseconds of behaviors.
I mean,
and that lasted for the rest of their lives.
So, I mean, but have you found it, done that systematically?
No.
But you should. Yeah. And this is...
Yes, absolutely.
It's a really important discovery, I'm sure.
Yeah. I should have. So let's hear something from Steve. And the other reason that I wanted to do two interviewees is so that you get a chance to hear what two different kinds of people experience. Sounds like, I mean, people are not all the same, even people who are like us, who are pretty similar by comparison to, you know, the world at large, I suppose, but we're still not going to be exactly the same, and we can get as much of a flavor of that as we can get. So, what has happened is that Steve sampled this morning and got something like 12 beeps. The beeper, by luck, happens quite often. He got 12 beeps. We talked at noon about five or six of them, and didn't talk about the rest of them, and then he collected another half a dozen beeps, so beeps 13 through 18 or whatever.
I call them 2.1 through,
which is what I would call them as well. And but at any rate, these are also new beeps to me. They're and new beeps since he has had whatever we would call this training from the first interview. So, at beep 2.1, in your experience, please.
Okay, well, I have to explain that, Russ, that after the morning's strenuous session and our feedback, I was feeling pretty dozy by the time I got here. And sorry about this, Walt, but I was kind of, you know, I was really in a fairly low state of arousal, as they say, during your talk. But it was, you know, as a result of the... the exertion.
So, you were having a religious experience.
I was having a late, very laid-back religious experience. So in the first beat, I was really kind of dozing. And Pradeep was talking. He was talking to you. And I could hear him in the background talking about mystical experience. But my eyes were shut. My arms were folded. And I could hear the sound of Pradeep's voice. And apart from the fact that it was about mystical experience, I can remember very little.
And did you know at the moment of the beep that it was about mystical experience, or was that something that you would then construct after the beep and say what he was talking about? So the question is, were you at all tracking his meaning at the moment of the beep, or were you just somehow hearing the
sound? I was struggling to kind of understand what he was saying, you know, before the beep was going off, and I knew I could, you know, just pick up enough to know that it was about mystical experience. And also because we've been talking earlier about it. So I, you know, it was I was kind of, you know, up and I was on the surface of sleep, between sleep and wakefulness.
And when you say you were struggling, do you mean that were as in the past tense you had been struggling, but at the end of this moment you were just dozing?
Yeah.
So there was no struggle per se at the moment of this particular meeting?
I can't really remember whether I was, I probably at that moment, for maybe a few seconds or more, I was more kind of quiescent than, struggling.
So when
Because I remember, I had that sort of, experience.
Okay. So I, because
I felt slightly, I guess I can add now, that I probably felt slightly taken aback, you know, or, yeah.
Okay.
Possibly a bit disappointed with myself that, you know.
Okay. So I'm going to come back and maybe ask him some more questions, but before I forget it, because I'm tired too, but I've got a couple of things to say. One is, if the beat has a startle effect, because you're drowsy or whatever, then maybe the multiple drafts thing could possibly work, because I think the beat, if the beat startles you, whatever was going on is a done deal. You can't remember that, whether it was one thing or 10 things. So an ill configured beat will destroy consciousness, whatever that is, I think. And the other thing I wanted to say is that the interview, Steve is saying that the interview tired him out, and that is a frequent thing. These interviews are hard work for the interviewer and the interviewee, and we went for an hour, and I almost never go for more than an hour because we're both tired at the end of an hour. So at this particular beep, I gather that you're mostly dozing, a little bit tracking Pradeep's question enough to know that he's talking about mystical experience, but not much more than that.
Yeah. I probably had more of the sense of what he was saying, but I kind of lost it and I can't remember it now.
Okay.
Well, twice now Steve has used the word probably. Would you take that as a cue that Nick might be going towards embellishment?
Yes. Well, that word probably is what I call a subjunctification. That's my technical term for that kind of thing. And I probably should have pointed out Claire had a few of those at times too. I call it a subjunctification because people are quite skillful at moving between the declarative sentence and subjunctive mood sentence, as it turns out. Even very and this came as a big surprise to me, even very unsophisticated people, not educated people, move skillfully between the subjective mood and the declarative mood when they know what they're talking about in terms of their experience. It's quite remarkable. Sort of similar to what Claire was talking about this morning, when people's faces look this way when they're talking about it. The same is true with their grammar. So this is an organismic thing that people are actually talking about. So yes, I'm sensitive to probably as being something that he is undermining his own testimony. And whether he, in this particular case, I took him, most of the time subjunctification is something that is more a cue for me that the person isn't talking about their experience.
Yeah.
In this particular case, I took him to be saying, I am talking about my experience, but I really don't know what's going on because of the doziness, drowsiness. But yes, I'm very sensitive to that kind of thing. And when somebody starts to subjunctify, which it's sort of too bad that these are good subjects, that it's almost a black and white thing. When somebody starts to subjectify, you know immediately they're not talking about experience anymore. These guys are too good for me. So, anything else of interest in that particular view?
No, other than I recorded the fact that I was aware of the sound of Pradeep's voice. So there was a very, I had a kind of auditory.
And when you say being aware of the sound.
Because my eyes were shut, so I didn't have like very much visual experience.
So the aware of the sound is an ambiguous phrase from my point of view, and I would like to know what you mean. By aware of the sound of his voice, you might mean that you knew he was speaking about mysticism, and you might mean that you were paying attention to the particular characteristics, bass, nasality, I don't know how would you describe what Pradeep's voice was like. So are you paying attention to the features of his voice, or are you paying attention to the fact that he is speaking?
The fact that he was speaking.
Okay. And to my mind, that's a major deal, and I don't think we've seen any examples in that. But if you were paying attention to the characteristics of his voice, it's something that I would call sensory awareness. And sensory awareness is a quite different thing in my head from the paying attention to the perceptual awareness of Pradeep speaking. So I would ask enough questions to determine whether this is a perceptual thing or a sensory thing, and it sounds to me like it's perceptual.
It is true, right? Perceptual, sensory, and content.
Well, there's a lot of things. I wouldn't say true like that.
Okay. Okay.
That's nice. That's not what it is.
Right.
So, anybody else want to ask anything about that particular week?
When somebody reports what was in their immediate sensory experience, do you include the secondary feelings of, and this is not about Steve specifically, but say Steve had felt irritated at the beep because he was tired and he actually wanted to have a bit of time for himself, or maybe he felt guilty about not listening to Pradeep or something like that. Would you be okay with that as the primary content of consciousness, or do you just want to learn what the sensory content was?
If he had been irritated in his awareness at the moment of the beep, I would have been all over that. I would have been very interested in that. He did say he was irritated by the beep.
I said it made me kind of startled, but actually that's irrelevant, because that's...
After the beep.
Yeah, that's... Right. Yeah, whereas... So I realize now I made a big, you know, goof by mentioning that.
Well,
it is irrelevant.
That was irrelevant, and people say things to me all the time that I think are irrelevant, and I, as you saw, I let that go, but that did not count. His startled reaction was not part of what I would take as going out of the movie.
But had he
been irritated, or had he been anything else that was in his awareness, I would have been very interested in that. In the same sense that I was interested in Claire's spreading out happiness.
But you said the fact that he was startled could change your interpretation of his recall.
Well, I would expect that he would, if when he says he's startled, I'm expecting that he doesn't do a very good job of this.
But it's important to you to know that he's startled, isn't it?
Yes.
I'm sort of interested in the word drowsy and whether that's a content of consciousness or not. Because I know for myself, drowsy actually has a lot of content. You know, there's a lot of characteristics to what makes me drowsy, for example. Maybe disturbances in my mind or inability to focus or disturbances in my body. And I noticed that we just sort of took drowsy for granted.
Well,
then went in on to content in.
You want to ask somebody? I'm really like that.
And I guess I'm asking you, Russ, not Steve. Do you ever get people giving, you know, that kind of feedback in terms of content of their mental texture of their mental state?
Let me answer the question this way.
Yeah.
At the moment of this beep, were you aware that you were drowsy, or was it just the fact of the universe that Steve was drowsy? And by the moment,
I find that really difficult to answer with, you know, honesty, because I know I was aware at various points. You know, I kept saying, "Oh, I'm drowsy," and I was even saying to myself on occasion before the beep sounded, "Oh, I'm drowsy. You know, this is going to be pretty terrible if the beep happens now." But whether at that particular moment I was thinking to myself that I was drowsy, I think not. I think I was actually I was in a lower state of, I was more drowsy than it would have been.
Never.
Yeah. You know what I'm trying to say. I'm too drowsy to be able to be thinking that I was drowsy.
And that's how I understood what he had said in the first place, and that's why I didn't ask any more questions about that. If I had detected from what he had said that he had been aware of his drowsiness, I would have been very interested in the awareness of his drowsiness.
So you do get people who are, what should I say, into the content of their drowsiness.
But that is what
lucid dreaming, I guess, was a.
Well, if the beep had come in one of those times when you were saying, "Oh, I'm drowsy, I should do something about this," or whatever, then I would have been interested in that. Mm-hmm. But that isn't what.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't what he was talking about.
Right.
Steve, may I ask you, how did you proceed just now to answer this question?
Wendell's question.
Wendell's question.
I can't remember.
I asked the question about, or do you mean Wendell's question?
Yeah, Wendell asked the question of Russ, and Russ asked the question of Steve.
Right. I just thought back, and I thought back and realized that I wasn't thinking that I was drowsy. And I probably did have a certain kind of subjunctive thought. Well, I would have been too drowsy to have thought that.
You absolutely did have, and I should have called your attention to it. You were subjunctified all over the place, not only in your choice of grammar, but in the way you answered that question. Well, maybe actually, I could have thought, the whole tone of voice conveyed that you weren't sure of that answer. And so I would not have credited that answer, no matter which answer that he gave, actually. I just think he's not capable of knowing the answer to that. If he gets into that kind of mode, as you all saw here a few minutes ago, I'm thinking he doesn't know the answer to this question. And so
I used to have an uncle who said to me, you know, used to say, it was his kind of dinner party thing, he would ask us a question and then say, "Give a man enough rope and he'll hang himself."
I ask many questions to people who do not know the answer. So, well, sometimes I ask people who don't, or sometimes people tell me things that I don't believe, let's put that way.
Yeah.
And I sometimes will ask them to clarify, but if no matter what I had asked at the end of that, of that sequence, it wouldn't have been to try to get the answer to it. Because I think he had demonstrated to me he doesn't know what the answer is. I might have asked additional questions so that next time this kind of thing came up, he might be better at it.
But the thing, right.
But this experience is too far in the past for my, for me to credit the answer.
Mm. Okay. But the thing I was aware of was the sound of Pradeep's voice. I mean, that's, yeah. Okay.
2.2.
Well, okay, so this one, I was still somewhat drowsy at this one. If you want, I can lift it out and go on to one later. I mean, because there isn't that much here anyway. So I'm happy to skip this one because, you know, the later one's more interesting maybe.
Okay.
But if you want, we can proceed.
I'm happy to see it.
Okay, all right. 2.2.
Okay. So if anybody wants to hear it.
He was hiding something.
No, it's just another
he is. I debated asking him to do it because very many times people will say, "Well, I'll skip the speech because it's not very interesting." It turns out to be quite interesting, and I don't know that it's always because people are specifically hiding something. I think people don't know what's interesting, and what they think is particularly uninteresting, I usually find very interesting. Not out of any perversity, I think, but because people just don't know, and what they think is boring, I think of as interesting. I very often think it's interesting. So in general, I wouldn't ask for how to skip a beat, given that it's 9:11, and we're all going to be drowsy here if we're not already. Then we probably ought to go to something more interesting.
Okay.
See whether you can keep it.
I can't guarantee it.
It doesn't have to be real.
Okay, the next one is also about Pradeep, because my beeper seemed to be partial to Pradeep's words, because it went off again when Pradeep was speaking. And this time I was I was listening quite a lot to the content of Pradeep's voice, of speech, and Pradeep was saying that in the Hindu tradition you have monism, and immediately after the word monism, the beep sounded. But in fact, as the word monism, as he said the word monism, I kind of, my ears pricked up, because that made me think about Spinoza, which I'm very interested in, and so what happened was that Pradeep said this sentence about in the Hindu tradition you have monism, and I thought about Spinoza, and the beep sounded.
Okay.
And then I noted it down. And at the time I was looking, I was conscious, and then I noted this down, of I had a visual consciousness of Pradeep's face, probably in profile. I was sitting over there where Wendell is. So, and Pradeep was sitting where he's sitting now. So I was looking through, towards Pradeep.
So is one of these things more salient to you, the Spinoza thought, the monism conversation, Pradeep's profile, is one of those?
Pradeep's talking and the facial image, perception, were equally salient.
More salient than the Spinoza thought?
The Spinoza thought was less salient.
Okay. And so were you interested in the content of what you were saying, not the characteristics of his voice or
his
everything?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you're seeing him?
Yeah.
Okay. And any particular aspect of that, or
you just, his profile.
But so you're watching him speak.
Yeah.
It's not like you're noting the color of his hair.
No.
Okay. And then about the Spinoza thought, can you tell us how that thought comes to you? What is the phenomenon of a Spinoza thought? I made a bad joke, so let me retract the joke. I didn't want that. I should have asked him about how this particular thought came to him, because I really don't know what, I don't care at all about Spinoza thoughts in general, or any kind of thoughts in general. Yeah. I should have asked about this specific thought, and I shouldn't want to give him a miscue here, so. How did this particular thought come to you?
I was thinking, I wonder how the monism that Pradeep is talking about relates to the monism of Spinoza.
And when you say, I was thinking, I wonder how this monism relates to that one, do you mean to say, I was thinking, quote, I wonder how this, or were you just wondering that?
That's an approximation to how I was putting it in my mind's mouth, if you like.
Okay, well, was your mind's mouth putting this thought into words, or was this thought there with words?
Roughly, yeah.
And by roughly words, what exactly do you mean?
I mean exactly that. I mean, what do I mean? I can't be more specific than to say that I was wondering, and there was something like a verbal a vehicle to my wondering.
Okay. And by something like a verbal vehicle,
I didn't actually hear myself pronounce the words. Maybe I want to withdraw that. Maybe I just want to say I was wondering, and had I been thinking aloud, I would have used words something like this, and maybe the words were there, but I don't know. Okay. So I'm going to withdraw that.
Okay. So let me interrupt this question, because this is a textbook example, as you might say, of the way an early example of what I call uncymbolized thinking sounds like. This is a person who has said who has said something that sounded like in terms of your verbal. I was thinking, quote, I wonder, and then he withdraws from that. Well, I was just wondering. And then
That it was a wordless. It's not that I'm saying it was a wordless one. I'm just saying I don't I can't be confident.
I understood you, and I'm saying this is what people on the second sampling day say. When on the third sampling day, they're quite confident that there was no words.
Oh, okay.
And I would, in a regular sampling situation, I would not have the conversation that I'm having right now, because I would leave open the possibility that there really were words and he forgot, or that there was something of a presentiment of words that will become easier maybe for him to find. I'm just telling you, I've been doing this for 30 years, and this is what happens is on the third day he's going to say, I'm sure there weren't any words there.
So is this, I mean, in a certain sense, there just seems to be some implicit association for...
No, for it's distinctly not that.
And Spinoza.
If my supposition of what is likely to happen, I'm totally comfortable and I think pretty skillful at bracketing my own presupposition here. I'm thinking that this is going to turn out to be uncivilized thinking, but I really don't give a shit whether it is or not. And it's gonna. And if it is, fine. And if it isn't, fine. So I'm not going to be leading him in the direction of that. But if it is, when he gets to be good at telling us about uncivilized thinking, which generally takes 3 days, why did that take 3 days? I don't know. But people are not usually very good at telling me about uncivilized thinking until the third day.
Uncivilized thinking is a very loaded. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean a thought that is very often carried by the word wondering. I was wondering whether Spinoza's view of monism is the same as Hindu monism or whatever that thought was about. It's not, it's not just a presentiment. I forget what your word was. A sort of a general sense, but it's quite specific. Usually,
I was just saying it seems like an implicit in the association mechanism that.
Yeah, and that's
Spinoza up when he says monism, as opposed to, you know, why would Spinoza even come up when he says that word? So he doesn't need a verbal expression of the question because it's implicit in the association.
Okay. Well, so what I would like to say about that is, I don't know why or much care why it comes up. So it could very well be that there's some associative process that brings it up, that my method does not get to that. But there is nothing at all implicit about what came up. There is the specific, I think, probably, comparison between Spinoza's monism and Hindu monism. And that is not implied in anything. It is totally available to him. If this turns out to be uncivilized thinking, as I'm suspecting that it would be, so I'm trying to compress a few sampling days into one here. The typical unsymbolized thought is a very specific thing. Should I have a ham sandwich or should I have a roast beef sandwich? That just doesn't happen to be the word ham or the word roast beef or the symbol or any other kind of symbol, like an image of a ham sandwich or an image of a roast beef sandwich, which is why I call it unsymbolized. Different people use different words. Some people say I was just thinking. Some people say it's a pure thought. Some people say it's, I don't know what to call it, but it was like that last thought. But what they will say is, I was thinking a specific thing. This is exactly what I was thinking. It's not a feeling. It's not implicit. I'm absolutely sure that this is what I was thinking about. There just weren't any words or pictures or any other kind of symbol that I can use for it.
Do you think it possibly corresponds to the deep structure of thought? What's been expressed in surface structure?
I don't think so. If I'm understanding what deep structure is, structure is something that's below what is the actual.
No, I mean, all the semantics are all there, and in the deep stream, you know, Trump's can come to language before it gets then expressed in the surface structure. Because it's a very interesting question why we think to ourselves in surface structure, since we then have to return to the deep structure in order to make sense of it. Why don't we just talk to ourselves deep structure? I think the answer is we sometimes do. And maybe perhaps that is what our Steve was doing.
I guess I should have answered your question, I don't know. And I think somebody who's interested in deep structure should be interested in this kind of work and should do it and try to figure that kind of question out. But I don't know the answer to that question. What I can say is that some people will be saying to themselves in inner speech, what I call inner speech, I wonder whether that's the same. And when you look at, when they report that kind of a phenomenon, they will say, I was saying, quote, I wonder whether that's the same. And it's my own voice, and I stop at the comma and inflect with the, put a question mark, and if I stutter, I stutter, and when it sounds exactly like I'm talking out loud, that's how they would say that. Some people do that. In fact, quite a few people do that. But that's not what Steve was saying here. And so I'm led to suspect that he's likely, this is likely to be uncivilized to me. But it's also the case that some people are, that there is a continuum here, it's a fairly rare continuum, but there are some people who have some of the verbal characteristics. So they'll have a sense of the rhythm of a sentence, but the word, not all the words will be there. Maybe one word will be missing, maybe three words will be missing, maybe the whole thing will be there, and yet they somehow still feel that they're speaking. That's fairly rare, but then, so there's a whole range of phenomena, ranging from the thought without any words to words explicitly there spoken, and a quite separate phenomenon of words there heard but not spoken. So it's as if I'm hearing my own voice being played back, or I hear somebody else's voice coming back, or I hear some song on the radio.
Earlier on,
Nick,
you mentioned the somatic marker, marks that which are used in some ways on a bodily level almost to make, which, to help us make a decision or deliberation about a moral judgment. You have a kind of gut feeling, perhaps, something like that, you might want to say. But they can be, I think, certainly in Damasio's work, which he's used them in relation to people who are just making rational judgments, and he starts off with Phineas Gage, of course, we all know. But it seems to me that you could use somatic markers to make a decision between the ham sandwich or the cheese sandwich, or whatever you said last evening, without even having to propositionalise that at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this matter marks affect something effective.
If one more question about this. If somebody actually says verbally, gee, I wonder if I should have a ham sandwich or a cheese sandwich, and then the beeper goes off, and you've asked them to report on what was going on just before the beeper, it takes them about 3 seconds to say that if they're saying it in real time. So it's, you know, one possibility is that although they sort of, you know, express it to themselves as this whole sentence, it was really compressed. Or the other is that they're not quite following the instructions because they're tracing, they're going back 3 seconds.
It's a very interesting question, and it presents some methodological interesting things which I haven't been able to work out actually, but it is. Fairly frequently, but most of the time not, but moderately frequently, that people will say, I was saying this in my own voice, and it seems like my own normal voice, but the fact is it was compressed, and I was actually saying it faster, so if there was some objective clock going, but it seems exactly like my own voice. And so I would say, well, somewhere along the line, well, how do you know it's going fast if it seems like exactly your own voice? And they cannot answer that question, and yet they have some sense that it is speeded up. And I don't know exactly what to make of that, except that I asked that question quite carefully. And the only comment that I would make about that is in the editing of my recent book, spending quite a bit of time, I'd take the manuscript of my book and put it into Audacity, which is a text-to-speech, not Audacity, but Read Please, which is a text-to-speech thing, and then I would have that talk to me, the original manuscript, while I read the galleys, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And Read Please gives you control over how fast it can go. You can slide the slider up to 10, in which case it's talking pretty fast, or you can slide it out to just 5, which is normal, or you can make it go pretty slow. And I had it up to pretty close to 10, and when I paid attention to the read please thing directly, it sounded very fast. I was talking about business, it was very, very difficult to read, but that isn't really what I was doing most of the time. Most of the time, I was reading the manuscript, and I was reading. I found myself reading along in my own inner voice, and it seemed quite naturally at my own regular voice speed, and yet I'm quite sure that it was faster than that. And given what I do for a living, I could alternate back and forth, and it was a quite dramatic thing. I could do it all just by shifting my attention to the words coming out of the computer or the words
With this software, it's the same pitch.
It's the same pitch, yes.
It's not like a record that goes faster and goes higher.
Well, given the time, shall we do one more beep, and then we will answer the question that Walt had asked, but anybody who wants to think that this was the end of the line should have the right to think that this was the end of the line.
Okay, so in this one, this is 2.4, I was sitting again in that chair, and Wendell was talking, but I was... I was staring at the ceiling. I was having very nice thoughts about just the environment, the sumptuous, you know, environment. And I was kind of staring up there and looking at the lights and the roof, the beams and the wood, and just thinking, you know, pleasant thoughts about what a nice environment it was. And I could hear Wendell's voice in the background.
And at the moment of the beep, can you be more specific about what a pleasant thought about the environment might look like? And I would say, just from the same part of method, when somebody says I was having pleasant thoughts about the environment, I'm not believing that, because people don't generally have pleasant thoughts about the environment. That's a way too general thing. Either if he knows what he's talking about here, he's likely to be saying I was looking at the color or whatever. So I'm not thinking that I'm going to get much out of it. We're going to find out.
We can move on to the next one.
No. Let's see where I'm at.
Next one's even worse. The next one's fun because I was actually talking
about
trying to
get that.
By the way, I have those kinds of reactions, and I was just pointing them out. In a real situation when I'm interviewing somebody, I wouldn't say that kind of thing. I would be asking them.
I didn't hear what you just said, so you can, you know, be as rude as you like. So I was focusing on the lights. I was looking at the lights.
Okay.
But I was aware of the roof in the background. I mean, I was looking like this over that sort of period of time, thinking, wow, you know, I was sort of doing this kind of thing. Oh, this place is really nice. Wow, it's great to be here. But I don't know exactly what I was saying or thinking, verbally or subverbally or non-verbally, at the moment of the beat. But it was that general kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah. And it would have been that kind of thing. Sorry, no. I was winding you up.
Well, it seems to me that you said several different things here. You said you were thinking several thoughts, and then you said, well, I wasn't really thinking anything. I was looking at the lights, and then you came back to thinking that there were all...
No, I didn't say... I never said I wasn't thinking anything.
Okay.
I was thinking over a period of time, a few seconds, I was having those... thoughts. I was having a sequence of thoughts, but it may even be just a sort of cycle of thoughts, you know.
Okay.
And at that particular moment the beat sounded, what I recorded was looking at candelabra plus beams and roof, thinking about wonderful environments of these cottages.
Okay. And can you be more specific or not about them? Which of those thoughts was what I read more than the...
Well, just what I wrote down here. Thinking about wonderful environment in these cottages, but that's not very...
Ross, why are you rejecting sort of a priori that he could have been having a lot of thoughts about the wonderful environment?
But it wasn't really a lot of thoughts.
No, I'm just... That's what he says is actually true. That he was having a set of thoughts at that moment. Why do you have to assume that you can't have that time dimension in which you can actually have lots of thoughts?
That's a good question, and I'm not exactly sure of the answer, but it is certainly not that I don't believe that that's possible. In fact, many people do have multiple thoughts. There was something about the way he said that indicated that, I guess, the subjective fixation kind of thing, that he wasn't sure about what was going on.
No, I'm not sure, but I remember thinking at, you know, over the period of time that the beep occurred, I was having those thoughts, and I was still, you know, in that frame of, in of that frame of mind when the beep occurred.
People who are having bona fide multiple thoughts can be quite clear about that. I was thinking about whether I should have a ham sandwich, and at the same time I was remembering that I have to go pick up my wife at the airport, and at the same time I was hearing the sound of the baby in the background, and at the same time, that's not what he sounded like.
But I'm pretty definite that that I was having those thoughts.
Okay.
And you know, you can have a thought, and the thought can persist even when the words have stopped, as it were. I mean, for example, if I say it's late, and we all think it's late, you know, you don't just think it's late until the moment I've finished saying the word late. We carry on thinking it. Maybe people are saying it's late, it's late, it's late, or maybe they're saying thoughts about, you know, maybe they're having other thoughts like, oh, I wonder when we're going to finish and how am I going to get back up the hill and so on. But, you know, I don't see why you can't have a thought and it can persist even after the moment that the expression of the thought is finished.
You would say when at that moment I believed I received marks, for example, and belief doesn't have a time dimension, does it?
Yeah. But I wasn't believing, I was thinking that.
But there are, I mean, there are a lot of oppositional attitudes which actually are not, you know, linear in the sense.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, if it had been an angry thought, I could have had the anger, you know, that could have persisted after the end of the thought, you know.
One of the characteristics of what I call uncivilized thoughts is that, unlike inner speech, they can last for a long time, and sometimes measured in minutes or even longer than that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the characteristics, of, as it seems to me, is that people who have uncivilized thoughts are very often emotional people, and by emotional I mean depressed or blushing easily or anxious, a lot of different kinds of ways that you can be emotional. One of the characteristics is that people who are depressed have a lot of uncivilized thoughts while they are depressed. And people who cycle as being depressed now and manic then and not depressed now and hypomanic then, can, while they're being depressed, have uncivilized thinking, and while they're manic, have visual images. One of the characteristics of depression, as you know not know, is what is often called psychomotor retardation. And one of the characteristics of the thought process that I get to see with this method is that the thought process gets slowed down. People have these uncivilized thoughts, and they last for a very long time. The other interesting thing about that example that I just said was that most people who do cycle like that have no understanding at all that the content or that the manner of their thinking has changed. That is, while they're manic, they know they're happy, but they don't realize that now I'm having images and then I was having uncivilized thinking. And when they're depressed, they can know that they are depressed, but they don't realize that they ever had images and now they're not having images. Which is another reason why I don't like retrospective reports, because if somebody has changed from one cycle to another part of the cycle, they have no possible way, basically.
One of the characteristics of manic depressives is that when they're on the down part of the cycle, that the continuity between all down periods of the cycle, without any knowledge that they're ever not down. It's like, I've always been down, and my whole life has been this, even though in anybody else's perception, they're manic depressives who are on top of the world 1 minute, down the next.
I would agree with that.
But the other thing is, there was definitely an effective tone to my thinking. You know, I wasn't just cognitively aware of the surroundings as having, you know, the feature of being sumptuous. I was effectively enjoying the feeling of being in this very sumptuous room.
And is that effectiveness bodily or heavenly or...?
It was to some extent in, I don't know whether I'm just embroidering or whether, it, you know, I sort of remember it as being kind of here, but I don't know whether I'm making that up or, you know.
Just so I don't know.
In general, I tend to remember my emotions as if they're in my chest.
Right. I don't know if he's making that up either.
I don't know.
But as we get better and less tired, we would probably get better at noticing that and then writing that down, because now he knows. I mean, we asked him whether emotion is in his body, and he's going to probably pay attention to that. And next time, he's going to be a better subject to doing that, particularly if he's awake. And and that's another reason why I iterate this method.
You've talked about how people improve their skill level, and you also last year mentioned that the ability to do this, better or worse, has no correlation with education or IQ or those kinds of things, or gender. Do you find that some people are gifted and talented at it, and others are, frankly, have disabilities that really get in their way?
And are you referring to the interviewer or the interviewee?
Interviewee. This kind of self-reporting.
There are a few people who just can't do it. And that becomes a very knotty issue about why is it that they can't do it.
Yeah.
And in at least some situations, of which I've published a couple, I have come to the conclusion that they don't do it because they don't have anything like inner experience. That people who are more or less normal people, that is to say productive people working in the workforce, I think don't have the kinds of things that we would call inner experience, the kinds of things that we've been talking about here, feelings and unsymbolized thoughts and talking to yourself, and they don't have it. And so when I'm asking them to what the report, they don't have anything to say.
And you can't correlate that with education again, or that particular disability you just mentioned? Or trait?
No, I don't think I can correlate that with education. You stated a little more strongly than I would say. You said that I said there were no differences, and I would say I don't know of any differences.
Okay.
Because my samples are too small, and I've not been that careful about it.
So are you saying you actually meet zombies?
No, not in, well.
I have no inner experience.
High functioning Asperger's, cases like Temple Grandin, will say that about herself.
Temple Grandin, I don't think, would say that.
She's got a lot of visuals.
She
doesn't have any expression. She doesn't have conceptual. Yeah. She doesn't have conceptual terms like, but she can feel what it'd be to be a cattle going through a trampling or something. So she has a whole regime that in many ways is more richer than what most other
people. Mostly visual. Her experience is mostly visual. Her book is about that, called Thinking in Pictures. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to her about it. But to have no inner experience is not to be able to navigate your way through the world. It's just not to have anything that you and I would call inner experience, which is maybe a little bit hard to imagine, but this is the best way that I can say it. So and I should say we're at 9:40, so everybody wants to pack up to be able to pack up. And I haven't forgotten that I'm trying to answer Walt's question too, so say there are five major ways of having inner experience, of which we've talked about several over here. Inner speech, visual images or images in general, uncivilized thinking, sensory awareness, and
affect.
Feelings. Right. Those are like the big five most frequent ways. But there are some people who don't have inner speech. We haven't seen any necessary inner speech here. So inner speech is certainly not a sine qua non of inner experience. Mm-hmm. And some people don't have any emotional experience. Both of these people had emotional experience to some degree, but some people don't. So that's not a sine qua non of inner experience. And none of those five are actually, and so by subtraction, as it were, you could say, well, you might be a guy who just doesn't have any of those. In fact, it doesn't have anything else of the small five either. And that guy just apparently doesn't have what we would call inner experience. As best that I can tell. Now, maybe he's got some way of conceptualizing that I, in my limited interviewing skill, haven't been able to get at. But I've worked at it pretty hard, and I'm a pretty skilled interviewer. And so I think there are some people like that. I think they are, to some degree, disturbed, and that is to say, I don't think it's healthy. And
do
I
they have, think it's, are they worried?
They assume that that's the way the world is. Yeah. Everybody assumes that the rest of the world is just like they are. And I have seen some people change. One in my 2006 book, I have a chapter about a girl who was what she called a compulsive liar. She just couldn't stop herself from telling the truth, and so we sampled her, and it turned out that we think, Chrissy and I, thought that she did not have any inner experience at all, and she eventually, as the result apparently of the method, got better, or actually started to have inner experience, started to actually pay attention to what was going on with her, and eventually developed inner experience, and you can sort of watch it happen over the multiple sampling days. And as that happened, it was just seemed to be something of a life-changing situation for her, where the reason that she was dishonest was she didn't know what the hell was happening. She didn't really have a good way of recalling what had been going on.
So maybe she was having it, but not able to pay attention to it?
Well, I don't think so. That's a very difficult thing to piece apart, and you have to pay attention very closely to the subtleties. And I think that's not it. That's the easy way of looking at it, but I don't think that's the way to. I think it's just not there.
Do you ever get with people who have done this for a few days, or people who have some other practice, that they get into this kind of, a metacognitive regression, where they're kind of aware of being aware of trying to be attentive to the thought that they're having, or the feeling that they're having?
Meta-consciousness is a rare phenomenon in this work. It's not a non-existent phenomenon, but it is a rare phenomenon. The book that's about to come out, has quite a bit of that kind of meta-consciousness in it, in the subject that's in that book. But that is by far the exception rather than the rule. And I press people on that issue because obviously y'all are interested in it in some way. But the armchair introspection is full of meta-awareness. Beat experience has almost no meta-awareness in it. I obviously don't think much of armchair introspection.
Yeah. Let me ask a question about that, which is kind of in the armchair introspection mode, but it does involve... it has struck me in the course of looking at what you and Claire do that teaching is not so different. I mean, it's not as precise, but being in a teaching situation where you're teaching meditation or anything like that is like an interview technique sometimes, because you're asking people to do things and getting feedback and trying to develop it further. So that's been very interesting for me to begin to look at that. So there's one practice that I do quite from time to time with people where you take your experience and you divide it up into positive, negative, and neutral. And you ask people to just make a mark whenever they're having a positive, negative, or neutral experience. And people regularly report that they will have an experience that, say, they mark as positive, and then they have a judgment about that, and they feel negative about having the judgment because they feel like they're not doing the exercise right. Mm-hmm. So then they make a negative mark at the same time. And then they feel positive for having noticed that they're doing this. And so they make a positive. And that can cycle, like three times as typical. But that seems to happen quite often. And that seems like a metacognitive thing.
I wouldn't see that as metacognitive. I would see that as, there might be metacognitive in the sense of sort of a repetitive kind of thing. I think it's very common that people's marks about things are very different from their experience about things. So I have a colleague, in fact, this most of the world actually thinks that I should be quantifying this stuff more than I do. And so this guy wants us to put visual analog scales, so since he's interested in depression, so the visual analog scale, for those of you who don't know, it's just a, it's a line, basically, you say, I'm feeling good at this end and feeling depressed at this end, or something like that. Put a hash mark at the where you think you are at the moment of the beep. This is a scientific way of getting at what inner experience is about, or something. And it turns out that people will, very, very many people in the depressed sample that we got, will put that hash mark at the depressed end of this thing all the time. But then you look at the, and then they tell you about what the experience was, and the experience was like, I just met my friend and I was really happy to see her, and so, well, you know, what's the deal there? Well, they tell you, well, you know, you asked me whether I was depressed and I was depressed. But it's not in their experience in the slightest, as revealed by the conversations about what's going on. And that is, to my way of thinking, it shows why the questionnaire method is sort of flawed inherently. Because when you're answering some kind of a questionnaire about whether I was depressed, it's an entirely different, even though they're supposed to be rating their experience, it's an entirely different thing from actually trying to contact their experience and somehow convey about it. So I think it's just an entirely different modality and not indicative of what the actual momentary experience is. So there is, as you all know, a lot of people who are using beepers now, to, including me, years ago, I used to do this stuff too, asking people to fill out rating scales or Palm Pilots or whatever about mood changes or whatever, and I think that is a substitute. And you have to demonstrate that stuff is worthwhile, and you can't just blindly assume anything.
Just on the matter of cognitive issue, because I don't really care whether they're having positive or negative experience, but I am interested in having them see that there's this sort of judgment on their experience and a judgment on the judgment. That part seems to be interesting. I'm just wondering how you can handle that.
It's, all I can tell you is that it's a very rare event.
Okay.
Does your work contradict the statement by Thoreau that most men live lives of quiet desperation?
What a question. I don't think I know the answer to that question. Most people, let me answer it in this way. Most people come in saying, these beeps are really mundane, and I don't think you're really going to be interested in them. If that's what you mean by quiet desperation, I would say yes.
I don't think that's what Thoreau meant. Do you?
Yeah.
Tell us about the Master Wolf's question.
Yes.
I would like to answer Wolf's question, but can I make a vacuum stop for you?
No.
But what did I tell you? So, can I say more about this guy?
Henry David Thoreau?
Oh, Thoreau?
Yeah. Yeah,
oh, right. He was some recent psychologist.
Yes.
And my thought about that is that there's a complicity issue here, or a privacy issue, or something like that. If I'm cooperating with Russ and quite happy to report that I was looking at a reflection on the pond and thinking how beautiful it was. I'm not being honest about that. But if I was thinking suicidal thoughts again, and Russ had said, you are in control about what gets said.
Desperation.
Perhaps I'd keep that to myself. I'd be ashamed of being depressed.
Yeah,
your question couldn't, if that was the case, the data you want would be self-censored out. Wouldn't appear in the database.
I would be thinking there might be anxiety. Anxiety might be a common element. You know, another way of slicing it is that Thoreau was looking at a scarcity society, and this is a post-scarcity society.
In the mountain fragments of original sources of waking people up at random during life and asking them what's on their mind, did they interview the subjects in the way they're supposed to? Do you remember? I mean, people you know, the proportions that what the present dream state was in the dementia studies of waking people up during the night. Did they interview them afterwards, or did they just say to the same, okay, tell us what's going on?
I don't think I know the details of that, but I believe they asked them to tell us the details of what's going
on. They did leave them on.
But I don't know that I know enough about those things.
I've never looked at the original protocols. I know the statistics of the report being material during IMs.
I do think that there's enough evidence out there to say that you have to be very careful how you ask those questions, because I think it's quite possible that you can lead people into reporting dreams that weren't there. So, if you really want to know about whether there were dreams going on, you have to have conveyed by word and deed and sincerity that you don't really care whether there's any dreams or not. Mm-hmm.
I know we're waiting for what's coming.
I would say a little bit about just about the genesis of how you got into this particular method.
And if I can add a little bit to the question, just what you make out of it. I mean, I'm sorry, I didn't read your books, but do you make case studies or you do statistics?
Okay.
What's your question?
Or something else?
So I was interested in thinking originally, and I had read everything that I could find in the Arlington Library, as I said the other night, and it didn't answer the question. And I was interested in Roger Barker's book, One Boy's Day, but he was interested in behavior. And so I thought, well, I should follow thinking around, but I don't have a team of researchers like Roger's got. So how could I do that? Mm-hmm. And I came up with the idea that random sampling could happen. If you're interested, I can tell you how that occurred, but that might be a little bit off the track. But anyway, I was interested in random sampling. And I figured out how to build this beeper that I described earlier, and built up some beepers and started doing things like I just described, where I would quantify people. At that time, I'd give you a pad of paper with 42 or 27 or something rating scales on them, so that you should rate whether your thought, started out as about thoughts, was about the present or about the past or about sex or about remember. And I factor analyze those, making yourself look like a real high powered quantitative guy. And found repeated factors in a lot of different ways. I factored huge data sets in a lot of different ways, and so you could show that things were sort of the same and sort of different. But when I got done doing those studies, I thought, well, they really weren't very interesting, and I still didn't really know anything about anybody at the level that I thought was interesting. Nowhere as close to Roger Barker's One Boy's Day thing, which is what had attracted to me, and so I took a job at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, which is where I still am, and I had been sampling for 3 or 4 years by that time. In the first year that I went to UNLV, I wore the beeper every day for a year. So I get up in the morning, put the beeper on, and go about my day with the notebooks, just like that notebook, and record what I was thinking about, and not knowing anything at all about what I should do about that for a year. And at the end of the year, I had an idea that this was still pretty interesting, but I didn't really know how to do it. And I read phenomenology and a bunch of stuff trying to figure out how to do that. And got the Duquesne School of Phenomenological Psychology was of interest to me in that regard. And so I gathered basically some of the pieces of that that were relevant to me and found a graduate student who would be willing to try this out and sort of apply the Duquesne method and that method has turned out to be not all that different from what it is that I do now. I think I'm better at it now. To answer your question along at the same time, I think of my method as being fundamentally an ideographic method, and you used that term yesterday. Ideographic to me means that I would like to say something about Claire as a particular individual, regardless of whether Claire is similar or different to me or anybody else in the world. And I would like to say something about Steve as a particular individual, regardless of whether he's similar to Claire or different or whatever. And that, I think, is the fundamental datum of consciousness studies, as it seems to me. But,
so what do you mean to say you'd like to say something about Claire?
What would I say about Claire?
You say, what do you mean by you'd like to say something about Claire?
Well, I would. If we were to sample 4 or 6 days or something like that until we got 24 or 36 beats, then I might be able to say, well, Claire has, out of 36 beats, she had 14 of which included feelings, and of those 14 feelings, 11 of them included this phenomenon where feelings seem to start inside her body and end up outside her body, or whatever were the, what I call the salient characteristics of her experience. And the effort there would be to describe Claire's experience, dead on Claire, without trying to say, well, Claire's typical of a woman, or typical of a Frenchman, or typical of a cognitive psychologist, or typical of whatever category she might or might not be in. The object would be to describe her experience. It sometimes happens that I do groups of people, like right now I'm doing a group of bulimic individuals, and the task is exactly the same with them. That is to say, I would like to describe bulimic woman A and bulimic woman B. Bulimic woman A, not as a bulimic woman, but as Natalie, and the second bulimic woman as Sherry, unrelentingly, as best I can do, bracketing the whole notion of bulimia. And then when I got a bunch of these people, which now I've actually got sort of a bunch, I would then go across those people and try to say something about their kind of experience, which is typical of bulimia. That turns out to be actually quite different from what the world thinks about bulimia. But the only way that you can do that, it seems to me, is to start from the fundamentally ideographic thing, and then once you're done, make a true generalization across the ideographic cases that you have in mind. And so the kind of thing that I would find, and to use the bulimia example, use the bulimia study as an example, since I've done it now, I can remember it, the world, I guess, thinks, psychologists think that bulimia is due to the preoccupation with the sociocultural thin ideal, and people get themselves involved with that kind of stuff. Yeah. And what I find in, or what Sherry Jones Forrester, who's the latest graduate student of mine, who's the latest iteration, there's been not two graduate students, and that's the work I'm on about it. What we find is that the most frequent characteristic of bulimic women, mostly women, are that their attention is fragmented, that they have got a lot of things going on all at the same time, and they don't seem to be paying attention to the important things in the world. They're paying attention to this sensory awareness or that sensory awareness. So for example, the woman would be at work and her boss is chewing her out and telling her how she should be doing her job, and the woman is paying and the bulimic subject is paying attention to the highlights in the woman's hair. And, you know, she knows that the guy's talking to her, but her boss, who's a female also, is talking to her, but she's just paying attention to the way the light happens to be glinting off of the off of the hair.
It's like ADD.
And so it's not just sensory awareness, but it's multiple. That would be an example of what I call sensory awareness. But multiple simultaneous sensory awareness is going on at the same time. And another characteristic of the bulimic women, and this characteristic is one that I have seen only in bulimic women, is they have, in this multiplicity of thoughts that they have going on, they have thoughts that are there at a very low level. And they use different metaphors to talk about what seems to be the same phenomenon. One person will say, it's like my thoughts are fish in an aquarium. And I've got a lot of fish fish floating around my aquarium, and some of the fish have gone underneath the rocks, but their tails are out from underneath the rocks. So I can see the tails of the thoughts. And what they mean by that is that they have some, in awareness, at the moment of the beep, some presentiment that there's a thought that has somehow been stalled and is waiting yet to be rethought. But a more or less normal, non-bulimic person, if they would just leave that thought behind, and eventually they would come back to it, and in awareness there would be no trace of it at the moment of the beep. Another person would describe the same phenomenon as being strings, that have strings coming off of in my awareness. And somebody else would say, it's webs. I have webs going on. And there is also some kind of a connection, it seems to me, that people will say something like, when there get to be a lot of these webs, then I purge. And when I purge, the webbiness goes away. Now, that's pretty interesting, I think, whether it's true of all bulimics, some bulimics, the 14 bulimics or whatever that I've sampled with, I don't really know. That's obviously there should be more people doing it. But the reason that I think that stuff is fairly important is when we go back to the sociocultural ideal, I think it's quite possible that the reliance on the sociocultural ideal is the result of bulimia rather than the cause of bulimia. I don't know that for a fact. I'm just speculating. But that explanation would go something like this. So I've got this fragmentary attention, whatever that goes, and it causes me to binge and purge on occasion. And then I discover, well, this actually helps me out in this thin thing, which is actually pretty good. So I can use my newfound bulimia skill to acquire this thin ideal. And so from that respect, the thin ideal becomes more the result of bulimia rather than the cause. Now, I don't know whether that's true. What I would like to say is that I think first-person consciousness studies can make a horribly important contribution about this. If it is true, it's a very big deal. And we need to do it.
This is not on the specific, it's a physiological basis, but that when your stomach is stuffed, your blood runs through the digestive tract, and many people find that their thinking is more labored in that state. So, in fact, the purging of the digestive process may actually.
Well, that's possible.
Maybe the freeing of the mental process, if there's something about that mental process, is stalling.
I don't really know the answer to that. I suspect that might be a factor, but probably not a very large factor, because the binging is, and the time between the binging and the purging is pretty small most of the time, and they're pretty wildly out of control when they happen to a typical bulimic woman, so it's not the same kind of fullness changes my thought pattern or changes your thought pattern. I don't happen to be a bulimic person, so it's a different deal. It might have something to do with it. Yes.
No, I was just, when you said it had some useful sort of side effect that it kept weight under control,
I really have no idea here. I thought bulimic woman was a little bit heavier than the typical bulimic woman might be slightly heavier than she would like to be, but maybe I don't know exactly what the average is, maybe slightly heavier than the healthy average or whatever. But not much. And many bulimic women are very trim looking. I don't actually really know much about bulimics.
Why did you choose the subject bulimics?
I'm the paladin of inner experience, basically. I have been able to travel. Somebody says I got an interest in bulimia, and do you sample me, or a student says I have an interest in bulimia, and will you work with me?
Have deeper will travel.
So, actually, a colleague psychologist comes to you, or a bulimic person?
Sometimes it can be either way. It can be either way.
Are you known as a healer as well? I mean, you said there were some life-changing experiences. Is there some people coming, I would like to do it, or?
There are some people who are coming and they would like to do it. And I think some of them have heard that it's a life-changing experience. Or, mm-hmm.
So who would you say actually here is the first person explorer or researcher? You or them?
I think of this as a first-person plural deal, because I don't think that they can do it by themselves, and I don't think I can do it by myself. I think we can do it. It's definitely their experience that I am trying to get at. I recognize that I infect it to some degree in my question, so it's not purely their experience. But the goal is to get at
it's terribly labor-intensive, this work, isn't it? How do you, I mean, quite apart from the time and the interviews, how do you code them and record them? In a typical subject, which is studied over a week, say, how much effort goes into
it? It is very labor-intensive. And starting about 3 or 4 years ago, I actually started to get, when the other day I said I was sort of a lone ranger in this, and that's been the case until fairly recently. Now I actually have a lot of students who are working on this, but this is very new. The world seems to have changed some, and students are now interested, and people are interested. So now we videotape almost everything and put it on DVDs, so now we're developing a DVD library, and even put basically one interview, sometimes two, on a DVD. So a typical subject is with us for somewhere between 3 and 7 or 8 sessions, and they end up with 3 to 5 DVDs, some of which are transcribed. I feel a little bad about generally.
Well, quick question, Mike. Yeah, I'm sorry. My question is, aren't you shaping people? In a way, I mean, you've shown how disciplined you have made yourself in how you interact with people whose experience has been sampled. But I strongly felt that after a while you explicitly or implicitly were telling them, this is the sort of report I want. In which case, if I was one of your participants, I would, again, implicitly or otherwise, pick that up. And when I would sense in my experience, I would have been shaped, and you would get what you want.
Well, I think that's definitely true. The question is, what is it that I want? And what I think I want is as accurate, from what I prefer to call faithful, apprehension of your experience as you can give me. And if I can shape you into being more faithful reporter of your experience, so much the better. Does that change you as the result of that? Absolutely. How fast it changes you, most people take a little bit of time for that change, and so I get a chance to see what they were like first. Mm-hmm. And most people's changes is not totally dramatic, but sometimes it is. So there's definitely an experimenter effect. But some people can try to guess what I'm after. In fact, I suppose that most of my subjects do try to guess what they think I'm after and try to give it to me, because most people are nice guys. But sooner or later, I will, by their inability to answer the questions, or so if they think, so a typical subject will think I'm interested in what they were saying to themselves. And so they'll come in and they'll say, well, I was saying to myself thus and so, more or less like Steve did a little bit ago, and then I'll ask exactly were those words, and they won't be able to say what those words were. And then I would say, well, I don't really care whether they were words or not. If they were words, I'm interested in what those words were. If they were not words, that's fine too. And so I think I get a chance to undermine, or what I would prefer to call bracket, your presuppositions about what you think I want, except that I'm interested in what your experience was at the moment of the beep, and I try to make that explicit. So I do think I shape people's behavior, but I don't think I shape it in a particular way. And I think that makes me pretty unusual. Maybe not unique, but pretty unusual. I think most people have in mind something, and then they go after that. So the typical study of inner experience is, first-person experience, I think, is to set the content ahead of time. So I'm interested in images, for example. And so I'm going to study images. And so I'm going to say, well, more or less like we did in the example today, have an image and then tell me about it. Well, now, I think it's highly questionable what people actually do in those situations, because there it is clear that I'm demanding that you make an image, and I'm demanding you to tell me that you made an image, whether you did or not. And I worry strongly about what you actually say in those situations. So I think if you want to study imagery, which you have every right to do, then I think what you have to do is to give people a beeper and say, I'm interested in whatever it is that you happen to come to your consciousness at the moment to be, and then you can forget about everything except the images, if that's what you're interested in, what your interest is. But you have got to convey by word and deed and true sincerity that you're interested in whatever that experience is, and just throw away everything except the images. That's an inefficient way of going, and it's the only way that I think you have the right to think that you're getting an image that was a freely occurring view.
I think we ought to call it hot. It's really interesting. I think we could go on. I think tomorrow will be a hard day.
Well, thanks especially to Claire and Steve, and I just already called it hot.
Yeah.
Let's give them a round.
Yeah, they go back into the canopy. Yeah. So you can hear that. Sure. Guarantee.
Right.
Guarantee. What are your books? What they call
books? In order, I think they're sampling
inner experience.
Sampling schizophrenic and normal inner
experience.
Sampling inner experience and disturbed.
Who publishes them?
Talent is not a personal.